Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into essential knowledge and bring you the most important nuggets. Today, we're really tackling a giant. Winston Churchill's six-volume history, the Second World War.
It's massive, yeah.
Absolutely. Our mission is to kind of distill the core insights, his unique viewpoint, and maybe the lasting lessons from this incredible account. We want to give you a shortcut to understanding the war, sure, but also the mind of, well, one of its most central figures.
It's a fascinating subject for a deep dive, definitely. And not just because of the sheer scale of the war itself, you know.
Right.
What's really captivating, I think, is that Churchill wasn't just like an observer looking back. He was in it, living it, shaping it, and then writing it all down.
While it was still fresh, almost.
Exactly. So yeah. We're going to try and uncover how his own story is just so deeply woven into this huge historical narrative. It's a perspective, well, you couldn't get it from anyone else, really.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit. His unique viewpoint. We all know Sir Winston Churchill, the wartime prime minister, that iconic figure. But his authority to write this history, it feels unique, doesn't it? How did he get that lens?
Yeah, that's spot on. Churchill, born 1874, died 65.
Yeah.
He wasn't just a politician, far from it.
Yeah.
He'd been a soldier, seen action, a war correspondent, member of parliament for, what, nearly half a century, held top jobs like First Lord of the Admiralty in both world wars.
Right. He had this incredible depth of experience already.
And he was a writer. He'd already written huge works like The World Crisis about the First World War. But the key thing here for this work was his access. Just unprecedented access to primary documents.
Like what kind of documents?
His own stuff. Personal memos he dictated, telegrams he'd sent and received, war cabinet minutes, even like verbatim records of his chats with Roosevelt and Stalin.
Wow. So he's basically using his own files.
Pretty much. It wasn't research in the usual sense. It was almost like reliving it through his own paper trail.
That's extraordinary. He's both the main character and the narrator.
So this isn't just objective history then, is it? It sounds deeply personal.
Yeah.
Almost a justification.
Absolutely. You've hit it. It is a comprehensive historical record, don't get me wrong, but it's also very much his personal and, yeah, political testament.
Mm-hmm.
He uses it to justify those warnings he gave in the 1930s about Hitler when, you know, hardly anyone was listening.
When he was kind of out in the cold politically.
Exactly. And to vindicate his wartime leadership, obviously. It's a total insider's account, full of drama, high-stakes decisions. But, yeah, it's definitely shaped to defend his reputation, his legacy.
And that mix, participant and historian, that's what got him the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Right, in 53.
That's the one. For his mastery of historical description, his brilliant oratory.
Yeah.
Defending human values, as they put it. It recognized that unique blend.
Okay, so if we boil down this massive work, six volumes, what's the absolute core argument? What's the big message Churchill is trying to get across about World War II?
At its heart, the central thesis is powerful, and kind of sad, really. He argues that this whole global catastrophe was an unnecessary war.
Unnecessary? That's a strong word.
It is. He genuinely believed it could have been avoided, or at least contained, if the Western democracies had shown more backbone earlier on.
So a failure of statesmanship, essentially.
That's exactly how he frames it. He argues it was born from, well, the follies, the weaknesses, the inaction after World War I.
Like what specifically?
Things like failing to properly enforce the Treaty of Versailles. He saw that as just inviting Germany to rearm.
Okay.
The reluctance to challenge Hitler's early moves, Rhineland, Austria. And especially the policy of appeasement, Munich, you know. He absolutely condemned that.
He saw it as a betrayal.
A profound betrayal, yeah. He argued all these things allowed a conflict that could have been stopped to just escalate and escalate into this global nightmare.
He had that famous quote about it, didn't he? Something Roosevelt asked him.
Yeah. One day, President Roosevelt told me that he was asking publicly for suggestions about what the war should be called. I said it once, the unnecessary war. It just shows his deep frustration.
And that famous line about appeasement, the crocodile.
Oh, yeah. An appeaser is one who feeds a crocodile, hoping it will eat him last. Classic Churchill. For him, it wasn't a noble try for peace. It was a massive moral and strategic mistake. The war, in his telling, was this huge moral fight between freedom and tyranny, forced on the world by a lack of will.
And that massive struggle is what he chronicles across the six volumes.
Yeah.
Takes us on this epic journey. How does he structure that? From the early warnings to well, the end.
He guides you through it chronologically, but also strategically. It starts with the gathering storm.
Right.
This is where Churchill, mostly out of power, details Hitler's rise and basically says, I told you so about appeasement in Munich.
Yeah.
He paints himself as this lone voice warning everyone.
And it ends right when he becomes prime minister.
Exactly. May 1940, Germany invades France. Chamberlain resigns. He takes over.
Yeah.
Talk about a dramatic start to his premiership.
No kidding. Straight into the fire. Which brings us to his, maybe his defining period.
You could say that.
Yeah.
Volume 2 is their finest hour. And you feel it's written with that blood, toil, tears, and sweat, he promised.
Yeah.
This covers Britain standing alone. The Dunkirk evacuation, he frames it not just as an escape, but as this moment of national unity.
The miracle of Dunkirk.
Right. Then the Battle of Britain, the Blitz. You really feel the nation's defiance, him leading from the front.
Yeah.
And crucially, the beginnings of that vital relationship with Roosevelt.
The special relationship. Okay, so Britain survives. Then the war expands globally.
It absolutely does. Volume 3, the Grand Alliance, kicks off in 1941. Hitler invades the Soviet Union. Pearl Harbor happens.
So the U.S. and USSR are in.
Yeah. Forging this pragmatic, sometimes very uneasy alliance between Britain, the U.S., and the Soviets. Churchill immediately offers aid to Stalin, saying he'd ally with the devil himself against Hitler.
Quite a statement.
Then comes the hinge of fate. This covers 42 into 43. The tide starts to turn. Midway in the Pacific, El Alamein in North Africa, Stalingrad on the Eastern Front, huge Allied victory.
It's a turning point.
Definitely. The war shifts from defense to offense, which leads into closing the ring. Mid-43 to mid-44, this is about tightening the noose on Germany. Campaigns in Italy, the big strategic bombing campaigns, and all the planning for D-Day.
Setting up the final act.
Exactly. And that final act is Volume 6, Triumph and Tragedy.
That title says a lot, Triumph and Tragedy.
It really does. It covers the final victory over Germany and Japan, D-Day, liberation of France, the end. But the triumph is really overshadowed by the tragedy. Churchill's growing alarm about Stalin and Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe, the difficult compromises at Yalta. He writes about his frustration, trying to warn the Americans about the looming Soviet threat.
So even in victory, he sees the next conflict brewing.
Precisely. He ends on this really somber note. Defeating one tyranny kind of paved the way for another. The Cold War, the Iron Curtain descending. It's a powerful and kind of bleak ending. He puts you right there in the decision-making room, feeling the weight of it all.
It sounds like more than just military history. It's about the personalities driving these huge events. And Churchill gives us vivid portraits.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Vivid and, let's be honest, seen through his own lens. He is naturally the central figure, the defiant leader, the strategist.
Holding it all together.
Yeah. But then there's Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
FDR is portrayed really warmly. A visionary partner, a dear friend. Churchill credits him massively with guiding America to become the arsenal of democracy. Their personal bond feels like the bedrock of the Western alliance in the book.
That relationship seems crucial. But then there's Stalin. That must be different.
Hugely different. Joseph Stalin comes across as, well, complex and pretty chilling. Churchill respects him as a tough, effective war leader. He acknowledges the massive Soviet sacrifice. But he also paints him as paranoid, cruel, totally duplicitous. A tyrant whose post-war goals were a huge threat. You can almost feel Churchill grappling with needing this man as an ally while deeply distrusting him.
Unnecessary evil in his eyes.
Something like that, yeah. Then, of course, Adolf Hitler, presented simply as the embodiment of evil, this destructive force. All the moral energy of the book is directed against him.
And Chamberlain, his predecessor.
Neville Chamberlain is portrayed almost sympathetically, but ultimately as tragic. Well-intentioned, perhaps, but disastrously wrong about Hitler and appeasement.
Mm-hmm.
Churchill is quite cutting about his political judgment, even while showing some personal courtesy.
So it's this clash of titans, really, these individuals making world-altering decisions.
Yeah.
Okay, stepping back from the narrative, what are the big takeaways, the enduring lessons for us today, maybe in leadership or even just life?
That's the key question, isn't it? What's the so what? And I think there are quite a few lessons in Churchill's account that really do resonate beyond just history.
Yeah, I often wonder how much these patterns repeat, you know, maybe on a smaller scale in business or something.
Constantly, I think. Take the first big one, the danger of ignoring problems, what he called the appeasement principle.
Right, confronting things early.
Exactly. He shows over and over that facing threats early, however difficult, is way less costly than letting them grow. In business, that's tackling a disruptive competitor early, right? Personally, maybe it's having that difficult conversation you're avoiding.
Procrastination on a global scale, almost.
Kind of. It's a warning against avoidance. And maybe more deeply, it's about the courage to speak up when it's unpopular. He was in the wilderness for years saying this stuff.
That takes conviction. And his leadership style, blood, toil, tears, and sweat, that raw honesty.
That's the second big lesson, clarity and honesty in leadership. He didn't sugarcoat. He told people the brutal reality, called for sacrifice, and somehow that built incredible trust.
Not false optimism.
No, modern leaders can learn that. Transparency rallies people far more effectively, whether it's a national crisis or company turnaround. People respect being told the truth.
The sheer scale of the war also points to the power of strategic alliances, doesn't it?
Absolutely. No one can do it alone. Not Britain, not the U.S., not the Soviets. Churchill worked relentlessly to build and maintain that grand alliance, even with massive egos and clashing ideologies involved.
Dealing with Stalin couldn't have been easy.
You bet. It's a masterclass in pragmatic coalition building, finding common ground for a common purpose, even if you don't agree on everything. That applies everywhere. Climate change, diplomacy, business partnerships, community groups.
And just the story of Britain in 1940, that sheer resilience in the face of adversity.
Incredible resilience, yeah. For anyone facing their own darkest hour, personal, professional, whatever, it's a powerful reminder of endurance. Keep going, stay resolute, look for openings, even when things seem hopeless. His account of that period is just pure human spirit against the odds.
One last one.
Yeah, maybe thinking beyond the immediate victory. Churchill won the war against Hitler, but he was already worrying about Stalin and the next problem.
Seeing the bigger picture, the long game.
Right. It teaches leaders to always consider the day after. What happens after the product launch? What are the long-term consequences of this decision? Victory isn't the end. It's just the start of the next phase.
This has been fascinating. Diving into Churchill's work really hammers home how much history hinges on individual choices, leadership, and maybe a dose of foresight. It makes the past feel very alive.
It really does. It's a testament to, well, human will, conviction, leadership under immense pressure. And yes, it's his version, undeniably subjective. But its power is how it shaped the narrative of the century's biggest conflict. It's a perpetual study in leadership.
It turns history from just dates and facts into this grand human drama. So Churchill's the Second World War, his story, yes, but maybe a timeless question for all of us. When does trying to keep the peace become dangerous appeasement? And when is defiance, however hard, the only way to protect what truly matters?
A question that never really goes away.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.